Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everybody. This is Dr. John, and welcome to Scarecast. We got a great, great show planned tonight. First of all, I wanted to just catch everybody up on what's been going on in the lives of Scarecast and Dr. John and all of our friends. This past weekend, myself and Cody, Carolina Caricatures, along with Papa Stroh, the maestro of wrestling, we were at the South Carolina Comic-Con in Greenville, South Carolina, at the TD Center. Over 32,000 people showed up. It was a grand time. We saw all of our friends, made a few new friends, and had a great time. So it was wonderful being at the South Carolina Comic-Con in Greenville, South Carolina. Thanks, Rob, and everybody at Borderland Comics for putting on such a great, great show, and we'll be back again next year with you. Speaking of upcoming events with Carolina Caricatures, you can catch us at Captain's Comics West Ashley in Charleston at their Big West Ashley store on May the 5th, which is Free Comic Book Day. Cody and I will be there from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Free Comic Book Day at Captain's Comics in the Charleston location in West Ashley. So that will be a lot of fun. Come see us. Come see Mike Campbell and all of his buddies there at Captain's Comics West Ashley in Charleston. And let's see, what else is going on here? Yesterday, we are so pleased that the Charleston Post and Courier, what I would call a major newspaper, along with the state in Columbia, South Carolina, and News and Observer in Raleigh, those are major newspapers for us. And yesterday, the Charleston Post and Courier carried a story about the Lizard Man Festival in Bishopville, South Carolina, hosted and run by yours truly, Dr. John. And so I was so pleased to have that happen. I got some phone calls this morning. And then Strange Carolinas sent me a message on Facebook, and they're going to be coming to the Lizard Man Festival, which is going to be June 8th, 9th, and 10th in beautiful Bishopville, South Carolina. So it was an exciting time this morning here for the Lizard Man Festival. So a lot of fun. So we're excited that everything's going well with that. And by the way, I wanted to remind everybody to check my new column out at LizardmanSouthCarolina, all spelled out, .com. That's LizardmanSouthCarolina.com. You can see my weekly column. Last week's was, of course, the inaugural column about the Lizard Man. This week, I shared a couple of resources, some links about Mount Shasta in Northern California, which is obviously a scary, scary place. Very interesting. I hope one day, as I was reading that article this evening, and I thought that'd be a good thing to share, I said, well, you know, we'll probably have to try to do a scary cast from somewhere near Mount Shasta in the coming year or year and a half, you know, at least before the end of 2019. And I think that would be a lot of fun. So this is staying off with us, scarycast.com, and right here on Facebook at facebook.com/scarycast. We're going to have a lot of fun as we move forward to the Lizard Man Festival, of course, on June 8th, 9th, and 10th. And then don't fret, Charlotte CryptoCon will be back October the 7th at the Hilton Garden Inn in Concord Mills. That's going to be a blast. And then don't forget, Bigfoot Day celebration in Kingsport, Tennessee, coming up along with the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference hosted by Dr. John and myself and Matthew Delf of Mountain Empire Cryptid Research Organization. So we've got a lot of great things. John Dixon will be there from MUFON in Tennessee, along with Angelia, who's the executive director of Tennessee MUFON. She will be there as well in Kingsport, Tennessee at the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference. So please join us all for that. And one reason I wanted to talk about having guests from MUFON, the local organization there in Tennessee, is because we are very privileged tonight to have a guest that's going to tell us lots of great stories, and we're going to have some. He is from the Dallas, Texas area. He came to me as a friend of Lyle Blackburn's, who is going to be, of course, our star of the Lizard Man Festival. And I'd like to welcome Daniel Allen Jones to Scarecast tonight. Daniel, how are you doing?
Hey, Dr. John. I'm doing great. I'm really looking forward to our discussion here this evening. It sounds like you got some great event lines up, and I'm just glad to be here with you tonight.
Oh, yeah. It's really good to have you. I was really pleased that I don't know. I think what it was you had liked one of our shows or something, and then I was talking to Lyle, and I said your buddy Daniel was very interested in this. He said, "Oh, he's a great guy." So I immediately said, "Well, I better call this guy." Any reference from Lyle Blackburn's a great reference. So we are glad to have you on the show tonight, and we're going to talk about all things paranormal, supernatural, cryptid, and everything. The floor is wide open, and of course, callers, you can call in. Just go to scarycast.com, click on the link, and you will see the call-in number. Do not miss the call-in number. It's 602-753-1738. So we will be taking callers here in about 30 minutes, but first we want to get through a couple of stories here with Daniel. So first of all, one of your marvelous credentials, Daniel, is that you are the program director and PR director for DFW, Dallas-Fort Worth MUFON. And how long have you been involved in MUFON, which, in case folks don't know, is the Mutual UFO Network. So how long have you been involved with MUFON down there in Dallas?
Sure, John. Well, it's been about close to 2 years since the chapter has kind of been re-upped and active again here in our area. And, you know, it's just been a real privilege to get together with like-minded folks and to be able to share in something that not a lot of people really know too much about. And, you know, it's just a great opportunity for people to get together at our local meeting and learn about different things going on regarding UFOs, space exploration, the newest innovations in the, you know, scientific fields, and just a lot of other interesting and unusual topics as well, kind of like you were mentioning, paranormal, cryptozoology, and the full spectrum. I'm, you know, very much fascinated in all of those things. While I am involved in the MUFON group here, I actually participate in a number of other organizations and really try to make my rounds and get connected and network here in the community.
Well, that's great. Now, when you talk about things going on in the UFO and the space community, I think the big news today was the rocket launch from that gentleman who's one of the flat earth guys. I think he propelled his rocket up about 2,000 feet before he decided to bail out because he was getting kind of high on that. You saw that piece of news, didn't you?
You know, I gotten word of that, and you know, it's something that I think is worth looking into. It's worth being able to share and, you know, give the information to other people to see what they think and, you know, have that to consider, if anything else. And, you know, it's something that's relevant. And even though that a lot of people might not agree with that ideology, at least we can be able to respect each other in a way that we can look at it and say, this is interesting, but, you know, what can we learn from it? So, yeah, I'll have to really look more into that one for sure, but I heard some things about that.
Right. I mean, I think it's really interesting. I personally don't believe it, but just because I don't believe it doesn't mean that it can't be true. So I'm always ready to put that out there. We never really know. So since we never really know, what are some of the most recent sightings down there in Dallas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, that you could share with us to get us kicked off here tonight? I know there are a lot of UFO sightings down there, aren't there?
Oh, well, there's stuff all the time. And while we have an active group of field investigators and reports being taken, it's always something happening that usually relates to strange lights, typically. But then every once in a while we'll get something that's really pretty an incredible report that stands out. In the North Texas area, we have a lot of people see just your average strange lights, just really unidentified, maybe changing colors and things. And that can kind of be a hard thing to really discern if you don't have any context, you don't have any way to gauge if there's a background, if the moon's out, the stars are out, there's clouds. So a lot of times it can be difficult to follow up some of those more generic light, mystery lights type cases, just because it's not something that maybe as distinct as a definitive object or shape that can be seen. But that's a really prevalent one, is the unusual lights, maybe changing colors on occasion, or just amorphous shapes of light. So that's a really common one for sure. And I think they're interesting. Are they all, you know, I'm not so sure. Are they misidentified airplanes? You know, very well could be, or, you know, other conventional aircraft. But there could be something more to some of the things that people aren't readily able to identify that are just regular old lights in the sky. But for some of the ones that are more craft-like or have a definitive form, I think that's kind of where things get interesting. As you may know, we had a huge UFO flap 10 years ago. This is actually kind of the 10-year anniversary of the Stephenville incident, not too far outside of the DFW area here, where a large object was seen and then followed, or either pursued or accompanied, some might suggest, by F-16s. And this is kind of interesting because while that was a while back, 10 years ago, there are still sightings of triangular shaped objects and craft in that area, and other mysterious dart around and move in unconventional ways. So that's a really interesting and consistent area of reports is down there in kind of south DFW area of the Stephenville connection. So I think that there could be something still going on with that. It's definitely worth looking into after all these years if there's still a recurring issue. To me, that says that there could be something to it. You know, a lot of these UFO cases will have a report from, you know, over the years, some point where, you know, and something incredible could have happened, and then that's all it was. And we'll talk about it. We might have books or lectures, and, you know, it'll never happen again. But some of these have a bit of a consistency to them, and that's what I find interesting is when we can have a correlative form of data that shows that there's a higher concentration of activity in particular areas, it'll help us hone in on, you know, what's going on, what we can follow up with, and things like that. So, of course, we got the mysterious lights in plenty of places, but the ones with the definitive shapes, either a triangular or any kind of box shape, that's interesting. Of course, then you have the disc shapes and things like that. Now, some people will mistake certain angles of photos or things like, which, you know, a lot of people, when they hear UFO, that's kind of the go-to concept, is this alien spaceship that's shaped like a disc, you know, a flying saucer. But really, you know, it's almost not as common, and statistically speaking, throughout the years, there have been reports that have shown that things like triangular craft are more commonly reported than the disc-shaped craft. And, of course, just the ambiguous lights, strange lights, more so than that. So
I wanted to mention something right there when you were talking about triangular and disc-shaped. I mean, I'm not trying to be strange here, but, I mean, it's like we do have new models of cars coming out. I remember back when I was in college, and my parents and I actually saw a UFO. It was cigar-shaped. And back then, when you would read UFO magazines and all, a lot of the sightings were cigar-shaped objects. And then those seemed to go away, and the triangular model seemed to hit in the 90s. So I guess it was the new General Motors Ford or Chrysler of UFOs. They switched from cigar-shaped to triangular. But, of course, the good old standard disc-shaped model continued on. But have you heard of many cigar-shaped or Zeppelin-shaped UFOs in the last while? Because I have not. I have not.
Well, that is an interesting form that, like you're saying, you know, it's gone through the circuit. Many people describe the cigar shape throughout the years, and while it may not be as common now, I think that it is seen from time to time, and the proportions seem very large, as if it maybe could be a home vessel of some sort that other smaller satellite vessels detract from. And, you know, that could be the case. Of course, that's merely speculation, but I think that with those that see the cigar-shaped objects, like you're saying, this could be a different model from any number of factions, whether it's human or not. That's what I think is interesting, is that when you're getting into these technologies, like you're saying, you have all these different concepts of these models of aerial vehicles, or just what we're seeing in up in the sky. And so they could be submersible, and you have people talking about seeing things coming out of the water, unidentified submersible objects. So there's a lot of things that we're not really sure of, but these objects could very well traverse the air as well as the sea and in space. So I'm thinking that with something like an enormous cylindrical shaped craft, it could house, you know, thousands, if not plenty more, of the occupants, and again, human or otherwise, is one of the other questions that it provokes. And so that, like you said, though, it seems like the sightings of the cylindrical ones aren't really as common. That's something I've taken note of, but I do try to follow up with any that are seen. It's just not as recent, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Because I know, if I can go ahead, I'd like to just share my little story here. Interesting. It was, I was going to college at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I was a freshman, no, I was a junior. And every once in a while, my parents, we lived a couple hours away, they would come pick me up for the weekend, just bring me home, let me play golf, have a good time with them, and then take me on back. So there were reports all over Winston-Salem about UFOs being seen. It was all in the newspaper. And so they brought me home, and we were driving near the Highway 16 exit off of Interstate 40 near Morganton. And I looked up in the sky. I was in the passenger side front seat. My mother was in the back. My dad was driving. I looked up, and lo and behold, there was a green cigar-shaped object. And I said, "Look up here to the right." And they both looked at it. My dad was looking and looking up, keeping his eye on the road, looking up, keeping his eye on the road. My mother was staring up there. And it was very interesting. Nobody said a word. My parents were very no-nonsense kind of folks. They didn't believe in UFOs. They didn't believe in ghosts. They didn't believe in anything. But that night, and we never said a word. And I knew it was inappropriate to say anything. So we just kind of got on home. We all kind of stopped looking at it. We got on home and unpacked the car and went inside, and I made sure all the doors were locked. I can tell you that. But other than that, I mean, that was kind of a moment with me and my parents. We never talked about it since, but we all saw it, and it was green. It was in fact, I don't hear a lot about green cigar-shaped UFOs much, but that's exactly what we saw. I've heard a lot about orange, but certainly not green. So anyway, that's what we saw.
Interesting.
And It was interesting to the point that we didn't talk about it. And next day, my dad and I went out and played golf, and that was it. No further mention was made, but it is something I'll never forget. And we all saw it. We know it was wrong. And
you bring up an interesting point that people all over the world, I'm sure, have had a similar experience. Very much like yours, where they might have been in a situation where they encounter seeing something such as that, but aren't in the appropriate setting to be able to share openly. I wonder about how many people go through that and don't have a means of being able to feel comfortable with whoever they're with or whatever setting they're in to share or ask more. And so it makes me curious how many these stories or reports have just been, lost and forgotten because of situations like that. So I'm glad that you got to remember yours and tell it later.
Yeah, and you mentioned that how many people are uncomfortable with talking about situations. I mean, it spans the entire gamut. You look at the hashtag MeToo people who don't want to talk about sexual encounters. Then there are people who don't want to talk about ghost encounters. There are people that don't want to talk about when they have a psychic flash and see something that then happens the next couple minutes, hours, days, or whatever, and they don't want to talk about it. They're very uncomfortable about it. I think more and more I'm seeing that in stats that come out, more and more people tend to believe in ghosts. More and more people tend to believe in the paranormal. More and more people tend to, well, so many more people have seen UFOs. I mean, it's gotten to the point for me. I mean, I've seen so many of them, it just doesn't, it's almost not exciting. This past, what was it, two nights ago, it was Sunday night. I was in Greenville, and I stayed with some friends in Greenville instead of driving all the way back to Myrtle Beach. I had a little bit of business I needed to attend to this past month, well, which was yesterday. And so I stayed in Greenville. And so I'm out in the back, on the back porch, actually, with my buddy's dad. He and his wife had come over to say hello to me as I was visiting. And I saw a plane or something with some lights appear just over the trees. And it stayed fairly low. And I said, John, is there an airport over there? He said, not that I know of. In fact, no, there's not. And so we watched this plane. It didn't get very high, and it just went right back down. This was no more than a mile, mile and a half from us. I said, is there an airport over there? He said, no, there's not. So, I mean, and I looked at him, and I said, I guess we just saw a UFO. He said, I never thought about that. That's not right for a plane to come up from the horizon, you know, from the horizon, not get very high off the ground and come back down. And it was fairly large. So there you have it. I mean, people don't even notice things, you know. He noticed the lights, but he didn't notice, he didn't think about the fact that there were no airports from which that plane came up and descended into, because it definitely went back down to the ground. So, people see things all the time, and then they don't think to talk about them. They just take, you know, they assume their lights, they're commonplace, it must be a plane. A buddy of mine said that he would sit out in his backyard in the summer, and he'd sit on a lawn chair and sit there and have a drink and watch the stars. And he said, you know, John, I got to where he lives in the States. Well, if he's listening, his name's Kyle. He's a buddy of mine. He said, you know, I'm sitting there, and I know pretty much the traffic pattern of all of the airplanes coming in and out that are going toward Charlotte, and they're going toward Hickory. And about once a night, I see one that doesn't match a standard pattern. And then I'll watch it, and then all of a sudden it'll disappear. So about every night he sees an unidentified flying object. So it happens. At least he's out there watching it, and he knows what he's seeing. He knows the standard airplane traffic patterns because he's like me. He likes to just sit and watch the night sky. But he certainly knows when something's normal and when it's not. And I guess that's the one thing that we need to be a little more curious, and we need to watch more to see what, you know, are these things that really could be normal, are they normal? Is there an airport over there or not? Is this the normal traffic pattern that you see at night? And I think that's what we need to do. I believe people tend to get a little too complacent, don't you?
Well, I think so, and you bring up another good point, is that out of all the reports that groups like MUFON and other investigative organizations receive, you can only imagine the number that are never even filed, or the number of sightings that people have that are never reported or shared to any other group. So, for instance, you know, you could have, for every 100 people that actually see something that they can't explain, maybe only a small percentage of that 100 people even go forward and try to do something with that. So there's so much going on that we never hear about, unfortunately, that could be some really good stuff and helpful in our investigation.
Well, then you've got the case, like a friend of mine who's a UFO investigator from MUFON. He said that he got a phone number for a gentleman to call, and the guy was just scared to death and kept wanting to talk about it. And in fact, once he had the investigator's phone number, he blew his phone up for 2 days. Then all of a sudden, the investigator could not get back in touch with him. The guy basically stopped answering his phone calls. And then there are those folks that get scared and decide they don't want to be involved. And that's another whole category.
It's something I think a lot of people are hesitant to come forward with. But for those that do, you know, it does take a lot of courage and a sense of integrity to really not, you know, want to really come forward and seem as if you're a nutcase or something to that effect, but really not intentionally meaning to stir up any strange issues, but to really just come forward with a genuine report. And I think a lot of people have trouble doing that when it's such a scrutinized subject in general. And so it's commendable for anyone to come forward. And I think it's, like you said, with the more and more people that we have experiencing these things, it's inevitable that we'll have more reports. And moreover, I think it's important that we have the platform for people to connect and be able to share what they're experiencing in a way that, and we can address it in a way that's not going to be ridiculing of them. And so, you know, it's great that you can offer a show like this where people can interact in a way that they're not going to feel like, maybe they're being made fun of, or that they, you know, they're really just faking something or just making it up. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen enough that, and I don't particularly care what people think. I can't rewrite history. I can't change what I've seen. So, and I think you're probably that way. You know, like for example, and I don't know if I mentioned I was going to ask you this or not, but have you had any personal stories about the paranormal or about UFOs that you'd like to share with us tonight?
Well, yeah, I actually think that would be really interesting note to carry on with. And just on a separate note, I'd like to comment again on the cylindrical objects that are seen. A friend of mine, Noe Torres, who's a proponent of some South Texas UFO conferences down in Edinburgh, and he's written a number of books on subjects like Roswell and other crashes of UFOs and things of that nature. He had written a book, I think is something along the lines of Aliens in the Forest, and it deals with the case of a large cylindrical craft that a hunter had seen while he was out in the forest, and he was suspended by harness up in a tree, deer hunting, I think it was, bow hunting. And he was so frightened by this object, as it had a smaller ground near him, and small beings and a mechanical entity came out sputtering toward him and started ascending the tree that he was harnessed into, and he just became unnerved and had an enormous panic attack and blacked out, from what I recall. But, you know, that's a perfect example of something that is more than just a sighting, but has greater aspects or features to a reporter case that can really mean something. So you can imagine the fright that this gentleman must have experienced and seeing not just an enormous cylindrical craft, but something dispatched from it and lowered down near him with entities coming out and then pursuing him. So there are a lot of different degrees of how can understand this type of interaction or this experience. And I think most common are the ones where people just see something in the sky and once, and that's it. But it's not often you get something that really has a lot of different dimensions to it. So another example would be one that we can get into a little bit later on, but to jump forward to your question that you would ask about my personal experience as well. I like to really be open and not assuming with it anything that I'm experiencing. And so for it, I like to open and accept the possibility that things are out there that we don't understand. That being said, I don't think I've ever really had an experience that I would say that I've seen a metallic disc or maybe one of the cylindrical ones or a triangular one that I recall. But aside from that, aside from the conventional spaceship UFO type craft, and again, not to my recollection, but I have seen what I would definitely qualify as a UFO, and it's one that is a consistent phenomenon that can be seen over and over. You go to this particular location, and they are what I would call a sort of plasmatic radiant light. And what I'm describing are known as the Marfa lights. And you may have heard of these as well, John.
No, I haven't actually. Tell me a little more about what I'm supposed to, what I should know. Please help fill in
sure.
some gaps here in my knowledge.
Well, of course, it's something that I think can be related to a number of other anomalous mystery lights, as they're known throughout and beyond. But they are basically points of light that have no definitive shape other than they appear to be omnidirectional spherical lights that radiate a variety of colors. They're very much luminous and self-luminous, and they appear to have some form of intelligence, whereas some people maybe have other ideas, and there are many theories. Marfa is in southwest Texas near what's called the Big Bend area. It's out in the desert, and there's not a whole lot there. There's an interesting history to this site before there were even really any kind of industrial buildings or anything like that. You have stories of the Western settlers coming through that would see these lights out in the desert far away, and they maybe assumed that they could have been Apaches and that they were fires. So they rode out there on horseback just to find nothing, and that they were never really able to really get close enough to the lights to see what it was. But from further away, it is what I would think is the same as it was back then, very much radiant, dancing, luminous balls of light that can be seen now from an observatory, a small viewing center that they've placed there specifically for people to come and view these lights, which all appear at different times at night and seasonal throughout the year, but they can fade in, and you'll see them from way out. They'll fade out or they'll appear, and you might have one or two or three or four or five or more together. They'll all move in synchronicity with one another, just with such precision that it's not moving in a ballistic motion. They're not airplanes or helicopters or drones. I would be surprised if we could reproduce similar movements and mechanics with drones even today with all the technology we have. But the Marfa lights are definitely an anomalous phenomenon that's been around for well over 200 years, and it's still happening to this day. You could go out to the viewing center and see it for yourself, for anyone interested. I highly recommend it. It's a very interesting, it's really interested in seeing any strange lights, or even, I would say that it could be very, very much called a UFO just because they're not way up in the sky, but it's something that's a little bit further down, and it's going to be maybe about 9 miles west of the main downtown Marfa area. But for anyone that's interested, you can always go to the viewing center at any time. It's like a rest stop that's open 24/7 with restrooms and a nice facility. But you go out there and they have an elevated area. Otherwise, it's a pretty much flat, rocky desert. And you can see for miles what seems that it could easily be 20 miles. And during the daytime, you can't really see any of the lights at all. But I've been out a few times. I've recorded. I've taken video. And it's such a fascinating sight. Whenever I first saw them, I just I had to really kind of double back and make sure that what I'm seeing is real, that it is actually happening before me, and that it really makes you reconsider what's possible, because when you see it, it has such a sporadic motion, almost maybe like a butterfly And that, you know, when you have two or three or more all lined up, all moving together in synchronicity, it's just like nothing you've ever really seen before. It's very fascinating, and it's so surreal that you really have to question, is this really happening? And I've been there on the viewing center where people just passing by have come, and they've wondered what is happening there as well. And so I'll kind of point out, you look off that way into the desert, even when they see them, sometimes people say, no, there's no way. That's not real. And it's right there before them. They're seeing it, you know, and even then it's still such a hard thing for people to process because it's so different than what we're normally used to seeing that some people remain in disbelief. And I've witnessed that, you know, it's very interesting, but I've heard a lot of interesting theories. I've talked to the town folk. I've interviewed people at the city and locals there. And some people, I think that one of the prevalent theories is that they are some form of plasma. Another theory is that they are basically a geophysical phenomenon, and it could just be a natural occurrence that has to do with some of the plates and the levels of that have maybe quartzite and other properties that are allowing for this sort of charged particle emission to take effect, maybe like a ball lightning, as some describe. While I think that it's okay to be considerate of that, after what I've seen, it seems as if these lights have a form of intelligence and interaction to them, or maybe just intelligence, and I'm hopeful that maybe we can find that if there is any way to interact with them, then they'll help reassure to us that they either are an interactable or interactive phenomenon, or if it's residual. And as I'm sure, being a paranormal investigator yourself, I'm sure you have undergone many different methods of seeing which residual or interactive in different places as well.
Right, and it's very interesting. I'm gonna drop the bomb right now. Is that what you just described are the Brown Mountain lights near my home in Morganton, North Carolina? We have exactly the same phenomenon. Been around the Indians report them since forever, and they are lights that seem to have some intelligence. They dance. They are sporadic. They are certainly. I don't think they're residual. I think they are temporal. I think they're with our current time, and there have been a lot of explorations. National Geographic Society came out in the 1920s, and they had people out there where the lights should be, and they saw nothing, yet people at the viewing station were seeing them dance. So it's very interesting. So this is not a phenomenon that is just isolated to Texas. My one question is this, about how far it's Marfan, right? Did I pronounce that right?
Marfa, that's correct. M-A-R-F-A.
Marfa. Yeah, is that town up in any kind of mountainous area?
I would say a few hours east of El Paso, and that whole area is desert and mountains, and this particular spot that they're more active in, it does have some elevation, it does have a few large hills, but the area particularly I wouldn't say is very mountainous, but the region that this whole South Texas sort of Big Bend area does have a lot of mountain ranges, and near the border with Mexico, it has a lot of different terrain features, but this particular area is flat enough so that whenever you're seeing the lights, which they have little killer stations, and if you can bring your own equipment and zoom in, if you look close enough, you can see that the light that is being emitted by these objects is seen on the ground below them, however many feet or meters it is. They definitely are over an area that is flat enough to where you can see the light as if instead of a shadow, you can see the light being illuminated from the ball onto the ground below. And that's, to me, a kind of an interesting thing because it gives you maybe a better sense of scale. I've heard different stories about sometimes these things, and people would drive out before there would be a viewing center. They'd just have a little lot pull in, and people would drive out to view them. And on one occasion, a gentleman parked out there and thought that there wasn't really much to do out in Marfa, but thought they'd go and see them anyways. And they weren't very much into entertaining the notion of the supernatural or anything such as that, but they were in the area and had nothing better to do. They went and viewed the lights, and they said that one of them went from the faraway area that you can see them from and came straight to them and just over his car. And he was so shocked by that that he jumped out to look over at the other people there to ask and, you know, to see if they noticed it too. And apparently they were too busy all jumping in their cars and driving away. So I guess that insinuated that something had happened. And he says, and I've been told that they came back to that, to Marfa, because they weren't a local, but they came through for work, I think it was, and they've come every year since then and never had a similar, in a sense, it made them a believer, so to speak, as if, you know, it showed them that there was something more to it than just a nonsense, you know, idea. And it really showed them that there was something to it. So it's a great example of how something like this can really change someone's life in a way that makes them more open to these possibilities. And the other interesting theory that I was shared about was there was a man who called into the city hall who said, I think I know what they are. I don't want to share yet because I'm pretty sure I know what they are. I'm going to send out some investigative scientific crews out there to do the research. And, of course, after a while, he finally said, okay, I'll tell you. And he thought that they were basically giant self-luminous pterodactyls. And I think that that's probably one of the most awesome theories of what they could be. I don't think it's very probable at all, but just hearing that there could be, you know, these pterodactyls that emit their own light, or some animal, you know, like these underwater deep sea creatures that have that effect as well. For some reason, this guy thought that maybe they could be these large pterodactyls that emit a light to, you know, capture prey. And the lady who was sharing this, she had lived there, and she's a local, her family had been there. She says that if they were pterodactyls, she thinks her family would have known, and that maybe there's a way they could have been surviving, you know, other than off little rabbits and things, and at least some remains could have been found. So I don't think they're ropin, as they're called, you know, these enormous living dinosaurs, perhaps. I mean, while as exciting as that may sound, I really don't think that that's what they are. But who knows, there could be something like that out there. I'm always interested, you know, other strange phenomena is here and wherever else too. But I think that my personal interpretation is that they seem to be intelligent and maybe a varied form of consciousness, as it were, that takes on what we perceive as this spherical form of light, whether that's relevant to any kind of mythological or religious concepts. That could be also another form of interpretation, but it definitely is stemming back into before the modern world. And I think that there could be a lot of things to that. And just as you said, this is not an isolated phenomenon. We have other sites like that here in Texas, but as just as you said, other states have something similar as well, whether it relates to maybe crystal mines or tectonic plates and geophysical phenomenon. That's to be determined. What really gets me is that after all these years, we still don't have a definitive answer. And that's exciting to me, that there still are mysteries. Even in our sophistication, we still have yet to discover really everything that's here. So I'm really excited. I plan to go back later this year and do further research. Whenever you see the lights, they make you just either want to run away or run toward them and figure out what they are. But after all the other people that I've encountered that have been close to anomalous flying or aerial objects, I think that if, you know, I got too close, it could be, I might get radiated or, you know, something like that. So,
yeah, well, you know, maybe you and I could take a look at where other types of phenomena like this occur. And I guess my first question is, as a PhD trained scientist, has anyone ever done a study to map out when the lights have been seen and how many have been seen at a time and over what time intervals? And I think that could be very telling. I don't think that's been done with the Brown Mountain lights. I think when the Smithsonian group came down in the 1920s, I mean, it was like, oh, okay, well, we don't know what it is, goodbye. But it seems like these might be a little more regular. And spending some time out there to determine, you know, the frequency, how often do they occur, how many occur at certain times, and see if there's any type of correlation between that and geophysical activity. Or any kind of correlation between anything that's reasonable, and go from there. I think that would be a first study of that type of phenomenon.
You're spot on. I think we need to be doing more work in those areas of the mystery lights, because I do think it falls under the UFO category as it is aerial. It may not be 20 to 30 plus thousand feet up in the air, but it is, it's not got legs walking, you know, like us. And so there are studies that have been done out in Marfa by accredited universities. And while I do respect that, I disagree with their results. I think that their results are very limited in the scope of what it can tell us and what we can glean from the results.
Well, what kind of results, you know, in general, what were some of the results that they got? Or that they came up with? You get results, you come up with them.
I should clarify, I don't necessarily disagree with the results. What I am not satisfied with is that the results are not a definitive answer. And what the results from some of the, like the, I think the state, Texas State University, the only thing that they could find that was consistent were lights from cars on the opposing highways being reflected. And while you can absolutely see car lights in the distance and perhaps some reflection of them, there is a huge difference and very obvious difference between car lights and the mystery Marfa lights that are hovering around in the air, and they're shimmering various colors, sometimes 3 to 4 to, you know, 5 at a time altogether. Those aren't cars. I think that the reports
they're stretching when they're saying their car. That's a stretch. That's picking any potential causation.
What I think I realized about those reports was that it was the only consistent data that could be reproduced same way on the same highway to give the same effect. You can reproduce the data, but the Marfa lights are not something you can reproduce because their interactions are sporadic. They're not predictable, so you can't document it the same way you could scientifically verify an experiment. And that's because of that, it's the only definitive information they conclude in their results is because everything else is not consistent enough to definitively give an answer to. So, yes, you can see car lights. In my personal opinion, no, they don't account for the Marfa's mystery lights. So it's something I've taken note of. I've noticed cars heading down the highway do look very similar when they're first coming, but eventually when they come up to you, you can see, oh, well, that's a car. That's not one of those lights. So I think because of their inconsistency, the real mystery lights, because of how sporadic and undeterminable they are, it's something that they have a hard time including in a report that needs to be reproduced in a way that we can scientifically verify these results. That being said, maybe someday we can go out and really find out for sure what they are or aren't. So I'm really looking forward to how that we can go, you know, take the proper steps to do that, and finding other places like you're saying that have correlative phenomena, and maybe that'll help glean some insight into what we're dealing with, intelligence, or as you said, geophysical, or maybe both, and maybe something beyond that we just still don't quite comprehend. But it's very fascinating. Again, I think it does fall into the UFO category. It might not be your conventional spaceship. You know, I don't think they're aliens per se. But then again, I don't know. And I think that's one of the most humbling things is we have a most consistent phenomenon of activity that you can still go see. I think it's most clear during the evenings and earlier on in the year. And I've been later in the summer when the skies are clear, when the there's not a whole lot of weather activity or overcast. I think that it's not a set schedule. I don't think they have a calendar that they go by. But then again, there could be attributing factors as to how perceivable they are and our ability to actually understand if they're there only at night or if we can just only see them at night from our point of view. So there are a lot of interesting yet to be answered factors.
Are there pictures of them?
Oh, absolutely. You can find a lot of interesting videos that depict the light and show pictures. I've taken plenty of pictures. You can pull up some of the work that I've done on my YouTube channel, Vortexes, and I give a presentation showing a variety of the lights themselves where they have I've taken a minute-long segment of one of the lights that I've taken still frames from over a minute-long period, and each frame of that same light is a different color, and that could be my camera attempting to interpret the frequencies, or it could be the light itself actually doing that. So it's something that I think we really have to pin down a lot more on, and so you could, of course, search the Marfa lights on YouTube and a number of other forums online, and something will come up, but it's nothing like actually seeing it. Taking a picture is one thing, but when you're there and you can see it, it's a completely different and almost interactive experience altogether.
Wow. Sounds very interesting. You know, well, maybe when you're, because I think you said you might be able to head up here for the Lizard Man Festival, maybe we can head on up to the mountains of Western North Carolina and see if we can check out the Brown Mountain Lights, see if they'll show up for us.
Well, I'm always open for an adventure, and that sounds like it'd be an amazing opportunity. So, you know, it's something I'm definitely going to keep on the radar. You know, and that's another thing is, of course, you know, while I help to direct a lot of the media and the UFO group here, I actually am involved in and interested in a number of other speculative areas and paranormal phenomena. So again, of course, we talked about our good friend Lyle Blackburn. He's a big proponent of cryptozoology and the study of strange and unknown animals and creatures. And it could very well be. I think that, you know, we might even be able to classify the Marfa lights. They are a phenomena. But if it's an entity, I mean, if it's a form of intelligence, then maybe that could qualify as a creature that we just haven't yet cataloged in our zoological, you know, studies. So there are a lot of strange creatures here in the Lone Star State, but, you know, even more so beyond. And so I'm fascinated by all of that and love traveling to visit different places. I've gone with Lyle to Falk, Arkansas, to Boggy Creek, where the alleged beast of Boggy Creek has been sighted over the years. And, of course, we have another similar site over here over my neck of the woods by Fort Worth that's known as the Lake Worth Monster or the Texas Goat Man. So there are a number of interesting stories of cryptids and strange creatures. And, of course, and you can't forget the, as my old friend Jim Mars, who I had the great opportunity to work with for a number of years before he passed, as Jim Mars would say, the smoking gun of UFOs would be the Aurora UFO crash of 1897, which is a really fascinating account. Have you heard of this one, John?
No, I haven't, and I was going to say two things. Number one, I want to hear, after you talk about the Aurora crash, I want you to tell us about the goat man?
There's, we've got, a few different ways of kind of understanding something similar, if you kind of get the drift. We talk about, how things like Bigfoot could have many different names in different cultures all around the world. And I think maybe we could be dealing with something similar, Goatman or Lake Worth Monster, whatever have you. But I find that interesting simply because it's a lot of concentrated activity in a very small area. And so Aurora, to hop over to that, is not too far away from this this other Goatman phenomenon. I don't think that they have anything related. Not that they couldn't, but I don't think that they're really connected. It's just interesting to see a high concentration of activity in a small area. But we can definitely jump in on that. I'll make a quick mention on Aurora for those who aren't familiar.
Yeah,
I'll give it a nice little
Aurora
preface
for sure.
Here. So,
yeah.
50 years before the Roswell incident, and even more so, only a few years before the Wright brothers even made the first plane, you have an object which was also, interestingly enough, described as a metallic, cylindrical-shaped object sputtering down in distress over the skies of Wise County, over the small town of Aurora, Texas, just 20 minutes northwest of Fort Worth, just an hour within the DFW Metroplex. This metallic object crashed into a windmill and exploded, scattering metallic debris all over and leaving the remains of a small body, which remains of the body were gathered up, and it was determined by some of the locals and an authoritative on astronomy that it was not of this world, that this body seemed to be not a human, but something from perhaps another world, as what it was described. The body was taken and buried in the local cemetery, literally down the road, and the remains of the crash were put in the local well. The story became a legend. Around the time, in the 1880s and 90s, there was a large airship mystery all over, and so many reports and many newspapers would come out about reports and articles of these airships. It could be very likely that many of them were made up. It could be very likely, or maybe it could be possible that this Aurora incident is also something that was fabricated. I don't think so, but there are those who do, and that's okay. I think there's enough information on the Aurora crash that there was something that happened. There's a historical marker next to the gravesite in the cemetery that talks about the spaceship that crashed and the pilot that was buried. So there is that. The local Masonic Lodge has it recorded in their minutes. The metallic debris was put into a well, and later on throughout the years, the family moved onto the ranch, and they wanted to use the well, but had no idea about the alien story. And found all the metal that they removed, and they got the well working, and they used it for about a decade. And then, unfortunately, they acquired very sickening maladies and bad illnesses. And they, after they found out about the tale of the spaceship and the alien, they always attributed their illnesses to that space alien and its ship, due to possibly radiation or poisoning to the water from the material. So there have been excursions done by a few different programs, such as the UFO Hunters program from the History Channel that came out and did an investigation. They went down the well, and they weren't able to find any of the debris. That's been kind of the troubling issue. I followed a lead that was from someone who I know personally, who says that they've held some of the metal from someone who lived there. And so that's the challenge is, if we can find some of the metal that apparently could have had some hieroglyphic writing and other exotic markings on it and some unknown alloy properties to it, It could very well be similar to the mystery metal of something such as the Roswell crash, which again was 50 years later. So before modern aviation altogether, nothing in the sky, unless you are willing to entertain the theories of the airships of the 1800s and groups like the Sonora Aero Club and NIMSA, very cryptic groups which not a lot of people know about that could have been in operation from elite inventors and technologists from the 1800s working on airships and dirigibles and things of that sort. But this one didn't appear to be such as a weather balloon or Zeppelin, but more so as if it was an enormous metallic craft. And, of course, something like that probably wouldn't have been around back then. So the Aurora incident's very interesting. Jim Mars was someone who broke the story, and he wrote about it and was well-known for his contributions. We together went to the city hall and approached them to see if we could put together a commemorative event to honor the incident and to acknowledge its official happening. And we were able to do that 2 years ago and hold a big conference. We had a number of speakers, and it turned out really well. The only downside is that the city does not really have the supportive infrastructure to hold an annual conference. Although I take it upon myself and a few others enthusiasts to hold a sort of seasonal tour of the crash site and the burial site at the graveyard, which you can go see. There is a local marker. The city does like the notion that tourists come and visit the places, although even today amongst the locals, it's a controversial issue, half believe, half don't. But they finally, as of last year, erected a monument to which people can come see and visit, take pictures next to. And whether it's alien or not, the city like to go along with the alien theme, and they almost look to be somewhat of a mini Roswell. And if they could pull it off, I think it would be a really interesting place for tourists to come see and to get a little bit of attraction for their city. So Aurora is a really interesting location, and I'm really glad to be able to share about that with you and your listeners here.
Yeah, I'm glad you told me. I was certainly not familiar with Aurora and what all happened there, and it sounds like there's a wealth of history. And it's just basically in Dallas-Fort Worth. How big is Aurora today, the town?
Well, you only have, let's say, about a mile to drive through it before you're into the next town. And if you didn't know where you were looking for Aurora, where you were, you would drive right through it. It's very small. I think it's only got just a couple thousand of its population there overall. They don't have a chamber of commerce. It's not a very big place. I'm blanking on the actual size of the town here, but it's a very small place. It's you can go a mile through it and you'd be in the next town. There's not really a whole lot to do. They do have some neighborhood subdivisions, and that's really about it. They're the only attraction to Aurora. The only thing they really have going for them is that they have a cemetery that has an alleged alien buried in it, and it draws in a lot of people from all over the world. So we help to show them that there is interest, and that maybe if we continue to encourage them, we'll continue to have more events to commemorate the incident and to bring people in to learn about it, just as you're doing, John, for the Bishopville Lizardman Festival.
Well, I have earth-shattering news for you, is that the population of Aurora has grown. In 1990, it was 600, and it is now a total of 1,300 people.
Wow.
So there you have it.
Well, there, it goes to show, it's a small town with some good old boys. And, of course, throughout the years, the story's changed, and, it becomes word of mouth, a legend, and almost mythical status. And that's the challenge, is when you go back this far, tracing the documentation is challenging. And, of course, if you can find people that are still alive, of which I really don't think there are. Fortunately, Jim Mars was able to track down several of them and talk to them personally, talk to the ones who said it happened, talk to the ones who said it didn't. And over the years, he changed his mind to really becoming more of, from less of a skeptic about it to finding more substantiating evidence, enough so to really think that there was something that happened, whether it was alien, whether it was a spaceship. You know, it's hard to say whether there's still something buried there. We'll never really know, perhaps, just because, you know, we would like to come in. There was a notion to exhume the body back in the 70s. Of course, that was countered by the notion that there was no next of kin for the exhumation. So you can understand that it's an ongoing challenge for the most curious of us, because, of course, you know, as much as we want to go in and find out what's there, there have been samplings and ground-penetrating radar results to show that there is a small child-sized grave under the location that it's supposedly buried in.
Well, you know, there are a couple of other factors that you need to consider. First of all, you're talking about the 1890s. Was the body embalmed? Is there going to be anything left, or was it not embalmed? Was it just put into basically the old pine box? Because that's about what you had. That was before casket manufacturers didn't really come into their own until the early 1900s. And if you have, I guess basically this would have been equivalent of a pauper's grave. I doubt if they would have spent much money on it. Would they have embalmed the body? Maybe, maybe not. If I had been the local funeral director, I think I would have been petrified to try to touch that thing and go inside and replace the blood with ether or with embalming fluid. I would have been petrified. I wouldn't have wanted to touch the thing. Who knows what kind
exactly
of germs it would have? So it's what on earth? No pun intended. But what on earth could you unleash if you exhumed that small box and opened it up? What on earth could you unleash that could be entirely destructive to the entire human race?
That's just it. And, you know, that's one of the main reasons that they filed a countersuit against the notion to exhume, was because they said, well, what if you dig up grandma? What if you bring back one of the diseases that struck the area, because they had some of the fever things going on, and they had a really bad downfall. And another notion, to be devil's advocate, the railroad passed through Aurora, and they lost a lot of business. It was a challenging time. Some people think that maybe the story was made up to boost interest. I don't think it makes sense that it would have been made up, simply because there was nothing going on other than just, you know, few years later, you have some of the earliest science fiction being written that even talks about things like Martians and such. So to think that people would make up this idea and have all this, you know, and just as you said, what gets me is, if this was a creature that was obviously not human, it's really surprising to me to give it a formal Christian burial in the local Masonic cemetery. That says a lot. You know, they didn't condemn it, they didn't burn it as a demon, you know,
The Masons are not going to do, they're not, in general, from what I know about the Masons, because my grandfather was a 32nd degree Mason, they are not going to perpetrate a lie. That is the one thing they will not do, and they would not write something down that wasn't true. I believe in my heart that that's the way the Masons are. And so you can feel good, a little bit good about the story, just because it's involved with the Masonic order. So it's
it's been recorded in their minutes as well. And so that also is a way to kind of help substantiate that something happened. And I don't know, it's a stretch to say that there's an alien, but that's what the city likes to go along with. And I think it's okay to really be considerate of that, but it could be anything. It could have been a subhuman. It could have been a subterranean. You know, it could be, who knows? You know, I think it's important to consider the possibilities, but not also to just immediately dive into one thing, because we're so still unsure that it could be a challenge. But it's just as you're saying, you know, if you've got something like the Masonic Order who's keeping track of it, that does say something.
Absolutely, it says something. They're not going to. And also, first of all, they're not going to say anything. I don't believe they're going to lie. Number two, to perpetrate a hoax like that takes, and please don't, P.T. Barnum, don't get me from beyond, but it takes a promoter like a P.T. Barnum to really promote something that's not true. You know, Barnum had a lot, he promoted a lot of circus oddities. And
sure.
Let's face it, some of them weren't exactly real. And it takes a real promoter to get out there and grind it out to make money on the man with five arms, who's really a guy with three arms and three additional appendages that you just strapped on. I mean, come on. So, you know, it takes some expertise in promotion, and that probably if there was an expert in promotion in Aurora, that would have been the guy that made all the money and would have already developed the town of Aurora. So you can infer that might not have happened. So sounds like on the surface from the investigation that you have done that Aurora might have been our first Roswell. And that's
one of the reasons why I had mentioned earlier that Jim Mars refers to it as one of the smoking guns, because it occurs not just 50 years before Roswell, but even before modern aviation, before the Wright brothers. And there's so many corroborating witnesses that he had talked to that he was able to document, and that they talked about the debris and the metal and attempting to find pieces of the metal. That's been a challenge as well. But like you're saying, and you did have people talking about the great airship mystery of the 1800s all over, and a lot of those were fancy stories that were just fictionalized because people like to sell newspapers. So there's that. But no, like you're saying, there's no one in Aurora that's, you know, taking in a bunch of money from this, saying, come, you know, come one and all, come see the great alien and his crash. You know, there was nothing like that. It was a big mess, a big troubling issue for many of the locals who had to go by carriage and horseback. Mind you, know, the cars weren't really all that great, you know, back then, so or even around. But
we didn't
have
the 1890s, we just didn't. Yeah.
So you have all this mess and all these people coming from around town to go see and really help clean it up and then take it and haul it off to who knows where. Which I have some ideas on, but you know, it's speculation after that. And we have to be clear as researchers in this field, not to go basically, you know, based solely on speculation, but to really follow the trail of evidence and you know, cooperative reports. And so it's a fascinating tale for sure. I'm really interested in seeing what we can still learn. But I do put together tours to go take people down to look at the crash site and the grave site as well. It's a lot of fun.
That sounds great. That's a good story for ScaryCast, something a lot of people don't know about, and we've uncovered it tonight for a lot of our listeners in Aurora, Texas. All right, now you got to have another great story, because these are we've talked about Marfa, we've talked about Aurora. What else have you got out there in Texas that folks over here on the East Coast may not know?
Sure. Well, you know, it's such an amazing place. You know, there's so much going on. I like to refer to it as the vortexes, of course. But it's something that, you know, as we said earlier, there's something in every state that I think really connects to a lot of these different types of phenomena. And like we were talking about earlier, I'm really big into these strange creatures, these unknown animals, and something that we have yet discovered scientifically. And, of course, when it comes to creatures like Bigfoot and the Chupacabra, and the lizard man, and other, you know, possible living dinosaurs and other creatures. We've got it all, it seems. There's been reports of flying pterodactyls. There have been reports of the lizard man here in Texas. There's plenty of reports in Bigfoot all over the state, but mainly in the eastern part and the Big Thicket and the really heavily remote forested areas that you wouldn't think, you know, would happen. But we do have a lot of Bigfoot reports. We just got a city over in East Texas called Jefferson, named the Bigfoot capital of Texas. And even over here in the Fort Worth area, we have the renowned Lake Worth Monster, also known as the Texas Goatman, which had a lot of activity back in 69, early 70s, where a lot of people went out to this nature center, this little rural area, and there was an island, and they would go hang out or maybe go on a date and or go party. And there were reports of what was known as this large, hulking, hairy monster that might have had horns, hence Goatman, and that it could have been white. There's an alleged picture taken to show a very blurry, white, possibly hairy hominid. And that's kind of an interesting notion that maybe it had whitish, light-colored fur, if that's what it was. The other big feature to this story is that on one occasion, 30 to 40 partygoers were out having a good time when they looked up on the ridge of one of the land features, and they saw this creature, and it hurled a tire at them, throwing it possibly 40 to 50 yards. And it's just such a great moment in cryptozoology history, simply because in what other instance of any strange creature do we have any more than 10 people seeing the same thing? But in this case, we have 30 to 40 people all seeing what was described as the goat man, Lake Worth monster. Now, there have been some altercations where people have come forward and saying that, yeah, during, my younger years as a teenager, we dressed up in a gorilla suit, and and that was me throwing the tire back then. And, it very well could have been a hoax, and maybe at some point some people did go out there. But I've been there, and, Lyle is a big proponent of the Lake Worth monster as well. He knows all about it, and he's lectured on it, and it's something that I think is open to the possibility of there having been a Bigfoot-type creature in Fort Worth. It's very probable, but it's not impossible. And so we look at the surrounding area. There's enough land. It's a little island area that it could be staying at, and there might even be more than one. But as far as now, in this day and age, there's very, very little chance that there hasn't been anything like that. I don't think that there's anything out there now. I don't think there has been for a long time. I think that if there ever was, that it was living in such close proximity to the city that it was already in a sort of dangerous situation. That, and I don't think that it would have taken up residence so easily. It seems a lot of these creatures, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, are nomadic or follow the rivers. They follow water lines, and they travel extensively to make sure that they're not stuck in one area. So I'm thinking that if there ever was a Bigfoot-type creature here in Fort Worth, that it was only briefly, and if people saw it, it's what we have. We have a bit of a hysteria incident where 40 people saw a Bigfoot-type creature throw a tire at them, and I don't know of any other story in the field of cryptozoology that's like that, other than a few cases where maybe a bus of students saw something in the mountains and others like that. But it's one that stands out for sure, and it to me, I think, opens the door to what else could there be. If there's something like this here, what else is there? And I'm all for looking into the other strange creatures around the area, again, like the chupacabra, which the Texas version is a little different than the Puerto Rico one and the traditional ones. But we have all kinds of interesting creatures. My good friends Nick Redfern and Ken Gerhardt, other cryptozoologists, they've written a book on the monsters of Texas. And so it just seems like we have plenty of different types of strange reports and stories. And we have the Lachuza, which is a sort of urban legend in the Hispanic community, where we have the owls that sometimes they'll shapeshift or they'll have supernatural abilities. And so there's a lot going on. And, of course, on the paranormal end, there are a lot of haunted sites and other interesting paranormal phenomena as well.
So you have shape-shifting owls?
The lachuza. It's something that it varies depending on the culture and the particular sighting, but that's one of the urban legends in, you could say, Tex-Mex folklore, which are the owls that are not just animals but represent a sort of spiritual manifestation of an impending issue, maybe an omen. So if you see an owl looking in your window at night, kind of mysterious, feel or energy to it, that could be likened to the lachuza. And so that's something that is one of the interesting tales that we have here as well.
Wow. We don't have any shape-shifting owls over here.
I'm aware of.
But yeah, that's pretty neat. So now the chupacabra, I've heard about it, but you know what? I haven't really done much research on it. Can you, as a guy in Texas, who's a little bit of a cryptozoologist for sure, can you tell us a little bit about the chupacabra? Because that's, you know, I know what the Jersey Devil is. We know about that. He's over here in New England. We know about Lizard Man. We know about Bigfoot. We know about Mothman. But tell us, just characterize the chupacabra, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah, well, you have two major versions of this. And I think because of the transliteration and the southern areas getting into Mexico, the chupacabra has become sort of a crossover cryptid simply because its original version in Puerto Rico, you have this sort of spiny, lizard-like bipedal creature that would terrorize and attack local farms and chickens and goats, hence why it's called chupacabra, which means goat sucker. And that's a lot different than the Texas chupacabra, which, as we can see happening in many different ways throughout different communities, urban legends become word of mouth, and the stories change a little bit. And eventually, you have strange creatures here that start getting the title chupacabra when rightfully they are not the same. And so the ones that we have here, known also as the Texas Blue Dog, and I might recommend a really good book by, again, Nick Redfern, who's written extensively on many different strange creatures, UFOs and the like. But this particular cryptid, the chupacabra, is more of, in Texas, the blue dog is more of a canid with something like mange that has been maybe had a mutagen effect based on its location, maybe due to its surrounding area or proximity to cold-burning plants and other mutational effects. And so that's one of the things we're finding, is that the blue dog, the Texas chupacabra, is more along the lines of a regular creature or a known animal, usually canid or a dog, coyote, that has lost a lot of its hair. It has a bad overbite and seems sickly and might move and have locomotion a little bit strange. But it's not a different animal creature altogether. It's just something that's had a mutation. And that might be what a lot of our cryptids in this field turn out to be. And it's something that we have to keep in mind, because as much as we might want the chupacabra to be a little alien dog or something, it very well is something that could just be a regular canid with a mutagen, or even sometimes raccoons. You can go on and look at reports, news articles, and TV clips of alleged chupacabras, and you'll see some where one particular one where a guy says he's caught one. He's got it in a little cage, and they have a news report on it. If you really know a little bit about your different animals and mammals and different things like that, you'll see that it's actually a raccoon. It's got something like mange. It's lost a lot of its hair, and it looks very strange. I mean, you look at a bear. Go search an image of a bear without hair. It's going to completely throw you off. So a lot of these Texas chupacabras end up being something known with a typically abnormal side effect. But, you know, nevertheless, they deserve a little bit of recognition, I think, along the lines of being a strange creature. And so it's fun to see how, you know, they turn up in different ways. We just can hope that maybe they're not able to pass that disease or whatever it is on to us. And I don't think that they can. I also don't think that they can multiply to make more. I think it's a form or condition that is acquired rather than genetic. So it's something that, you know, we're still learning about, and it's, you know, always part of the field work. We can really learn more about what we get more bodies. So the Texas Chupacabra is one of the staple cryptids of the Lone Star State. Bigfoot, of course, you know, which a lot of people may not think Texas and Bigfoot go together, but they really, we have plenty of Bigfoot sightings all over the state, but especially in the eastern portions, you know, connecting into the other Arkansas and even Oklahoma borders, the Texas area, you know, there can just be found with a multiple little iterations, like the Caddo critter or the Sabine thing. And, you know, these are just different forms of maybe what we could just say is Bigfoot or Sasquatch. And, of course, like I said earlier, there are reports of living dinosaurs. There are reports of thunderbirds, very large birds. There are reports of werewolf-like dogmen. It's just such a fascinating state, and I've been working on compiling material for an upcoming project, which I'm excited to announce here on the show, but it's going to be somewhat of a Texas bestiary to feature all the strangeness and creatures and oddities that are featured here in the Lone Star State.
Wow, that sounds great. That's a huge undertaking. Now where have thunderbirds been seen? I've always been interested in them.
You know, it's an old native tradition that the thunderbirds represented an omen. When they flapped their wings, it was almost like thunder and could be very frightening, and that if you were around, that you might not come back and you might end up missing or being taken. Thunderbirds, I think, are more of a northern tradition, but we do have some tales here. People seeing enormous, very large wingspan birds that just don't seem to fit into the normal size and scale of everyday avians. And so
Hold on. When you talk about very large wingspan, approximately how big is that wingspan you're talking about?
Well, it seems like from anecdotal evidence, we could be dealing with a large avian with a wingspan of 15 to 20 feet. And not to say that, you know, that there's one around here flying around that we can gauge that by, but I'd say based off of many anecdotal reports over the centuries, it seems like, from based off of native tales of old traditions that they tell about and our modern sightings of things like potential pterodactyls and things like that, it seems like the wingspan could easily be over 10 feet, maybe 10 to 20. And so that would easily qualify. And I know that there's a large bird that used to exist in North America that had a wingspan around that size. It's thought to be extinct. The thunderbird could very well be an avian, you know, more modern-like bird, or it could also account for relics, pterodactyls and living dinosaurs that are able to, you know, still be around in small corners of the remote world. And, you know, I like to entertain those possibilities. There are many tales of such, you know, but I think possible that these giant birds, which have been seen in the northern states and some here in Texas as well, could be part of a prehistoric animal species. And I think that a lot of cryptids could end up being associated with prehistoric animals. And that to me fascinates me.
Right, that there are pockets where prehistoric animals still exist. There's nothing that says they all had to die out. Now, there isn't. There's no hard and fast rule for any of that. And I think Aaron Judkins, the biblical archaeologist, who's down there in Texas as well, he indicated that when he was on our show here several months back, that just because something's considered prehistoric doesn't mean that it couldn't still be living or didn't live until 300 or 400 years ago. So, that's the thing that we just can't say for certain what's here and what's not. You know that, and I think most of the cryptozoologists that you deal with know that as well. I'm sure Lyle does too. You can't. There are no hard and fast rules. And the only rules that we've got are the ones
that
seem
really
to be broken.
Exactly, and it's a very challenging field because it is very ambiguous. Bigfoot is an ambiguous concept, just like UFOs. The term UFO is a really ambiguous concept. And so we need to make sure that we use discernment when it comes to this and not go off of mere speculation and to these lofty realms that otherwise, just really misinform the general public, because whereas a lot of classical cryptozoologists tend to lean toward many of these being yet to be discovered biological species, there are those on the other end who feel like maybe there's a paranormal issue or maybe it's supernatural in some way. And so I'm open to the possibility that there could very well be a connection. I just need to find more that lends credence to that. And I think that many of the people I've come across in my research and in my interviews show that there could be very possibly more to meets the eye than what we think about just a flesh and blood creature. And, many cryptozoologists will probably say something similar, but it seems like, we're breaking them up into different areas, whether they're mutations of known species, prehistoric species we haven't cataloged zoologically yet, or maybe they're just completely outside of, our normal scope of reality, or maybe something else altogether. And so I think it's abilities and to go into the field with an open mind, but to be set to do the work in a way that says, okay, well, if it turns out the DNA results show that, that it's this, maybe that's what we need to go with. As an example, and I'm glad you had mentioned Dr. Aaron Judkins, a friend of mine as well. I'm glad to have worked with him on some things, and such as the Star Child skull. Are you familiar with this relic?
He and I spoke about that on the telephone. That didn't get covered on our show. But tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, I'll just make a brief mention because he was involved. He was a leading archaeologist in that investigation, and this will actually tie back into what we're talking about here. The Star Child skull found in a Mexican cave, dated about 900 BC, I think it was, basically has a lot of mutations, and it looks different. It's an abnormal skull. It's not an elongated skull, but it has different features, possibly be a hybrid, maybe even an alien hybrid or completely alien. After the study was done, a few studies by the late Lloyd Pye and then continued on by Chase Klutsky, Aaron Judkins, Joe Taylor, and others. Melanie Young, the owner, was surprised to find that even though the results showed the DNA paternal and maternal were both Native American, that we can still glean some medical insight from an object which was thought to possibly be an alien hybrid, which turned out to just be a mutated condition and not alien at all. And so it's really sobering to find out, as much as we want things to be alien or whatever it is, that when it comes back not, it's okay. And we can still learn a lot, and it still expands our awareness and improves our abilities in these fields for what's beyond. And just on that note, there was something that came up recently in the New York Times about a small 6-inch mummified skeleton that came from South America, Atacama, and it had been kind of paraded around as a small alien mummy. There was a documentary called Sirius made by it by Dr. Stephen Greer. Well, there were reports done to show the same thing, that it is actually completely human, according to the results. Of course, you know, people can still disagree with that if they choose to, but according to some new DNA studies, it shows that something like that is completely human. And and to kind of bring that back to circle, when we're dealing with these strange creatures, they might not be so strange in that they're completely alien or something to that effect, but really just also known species. And that's interesting too. We can learn a lot of zoological issues with that, a lot of medical issues, and you know, many different things. It doesn't mean that it's not as significant. It's just different.
Exactly. And you know, the idea of mutations you were talking about a little bit earlier, you know, you got a raccoon that has mange and not a mutation, but just, well, maybe it is a mutation. But, you know, whatever it is, it, you know, it certainly looks different. It certainly looks scary, and we have to consider it. We have to consider all possibilities. And so, yeah, that's great. That's, so you, what did you work on with Aaron Judkins? What projects, or did you, you know, or how was your interaction with him? Because he's a great guy. I really like him.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was able to help with his premiere. Well, we worked on the Star Child Skull investigation together. I was helping with Melanie Young, and I did some interviews with her. He was doing a lot of archaeological and dating analysis, along with Joe Taylor, who produced some reproductions of the skull, which you can buy from him. They're really pretty neat. I recommend checking out his museum, the Mount Blanco Fossil Museum, who he works a lot with Dr. Aaron Judkins. But I was fortunate enough to work with them on a few events regarding the skull, promoting the information that was newly submitted, and the owner, Melanie Young, we did some interviews. You can go on and search the Star Child Skull interview with Melanie Young on our YouTube channel, and you'll find out about what she has to say. But Dr. Aaron Judkins also has traveled to Turkey and visited Mount Ararat, which is a very interesting place for those of you who aren't familiar, which is where what is known as the Ararat anomaly is located, supposedly an enormous piece of wood that seems to be somewhat like of a boat, or in other words, according to how they put it in Dr. Aaron Judkins' documentary, Finding Noah, which is alluding to it being Noah's Ark. So I was able to work with him at his premiere event. He had for one day in theaters all over the nation. He was actually at the theater of my hometown to do the premiere. I was fortunate enough to work with him there and to do some work with him to help promote that. And it's been a very interesting roller coaster with Dr. Aaron Judkins. He's all over the place, and he's a really fascinating and respectable guy for sure.
What I liked about him was he said the most important story about the whole Mount Ararat thing was when part of the film crew got taken away as prisoners, and how several of the tribes had to get together and negotiate to get them back. That was the most amazing thing. In fact, he detailed that on an episode of Comic-Con Stars, and you can go hear it. I don't know if you might know about that, but it was amazing that part of his film crew was abducted.
It's a very challenging place to get to, and I'm really glad that they were fortunate enough to be able to finish that documentary, because I don't know that they'll be able to go back. You know, there are many people throughout the crew and the process of that whole production have gone on many occasions, and it's always challenging to be able to get through. I think the Kurds and the conflicting factions there on the borders and in Turkey, it's just a real obstacle. So it's good to see that they're safe. But, yeah, like you said, it's very interesting. I definitely recommend anyone who's interested, check out Finding Noah. That's Dr. Aaron Judkins' documentary. And he also wrote a book on elongated skulls from Peru, which you know, I helped him with an event here where he gave a lecture and showed some of his skulls and some of the work that Joe Taylor had made repos for as well.
Right, and we hope to have him back here sooner than later. I'll probably have him back on Scarycast because of the general nature of what he talks about. In fact, I should just get back up with him sooner than later because it's time to talk to him again. He's always got a lot of really interesting stories. But I tell you what, we have really enjoyed our time with you today, Daniel. You've told us a lot. And when I say us, we have a lot of listeners from all over. We do have a lot of listeners congregated here in the Southeast and on the East Coast, and I think we've gotten a good overview of cryptids and things that go bump in the night over in Texas, which is extremely interesting to me. And we appreciate you being here with us. I hope that you can make it to the Lizard Man Festival and Comic-Con on June 8th, 9th, and 10th. You and I will be talking more about that. Hope you can make it, and I hope we can have you back here sooner than later on Scarycast. You think you might come back and chat with us some more?
Oh, I'd love that, and that would be a great opportunity to connect and just share even more.
Well, that's good. Well, thank you very much for being with us tonight. You've been a wonderful guest. I've enjoyed this entire event. And now next week, now be sure to listen in next week, you and everybody else, because we will have the world-famous She-Squatchers from Minnesota, several gals who go out and do Bigfoot research and exploration. They have got stories that you will not believe. In fact, I was talking with Jen Krause on the phone last week, and we were talking. I said, Jen, we have to stop. We have to stop right now because this is a story for the interview. She said, you're right, John. I don't want to tell it, then retell it, and have it lose some of its details. So we got some great stories coming out next week with the She-Squatchers, who will be our stars at the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference, which will be October 19th, 20th, 21st, Bays Mountain Park, Kingsport, Tennessee, the world capital of Bigfoot in Tennessee, as far as I'm concerned. So, and maybe you and some of your buddies, Daniel, can get up there. We certainly hope so. We like having friends from all over come and join us and share ideas. So, again, thank you very much for being our guest. Next week we have the She-Squatchers. And as always, this is Scarycast. Dr. John, thanks a lot. Comment on Facebook, and we'll see you next time. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, John. I had a great time.